Hello, everybody, and welcome to In the Doll World, a show spotlighting the passion and the people of the doll community. With your host, me, Georgette Taylor, former vice president and co-founder of Big Beautiful Dolls, and Tammy Fisher, owner of Curiositeej Dolls and Collectibles. Join us as we talk to and feature fascinating new dolls and doll artists, from avid collectors to repainters, redesigners, bloggers, authors, and all the people in between as they share their journeys, give us glimpses into their processes, and what propels their passion and drive that help to keep the doll world moving and shaking. Here are your hosts, Georgette and Tammy.
Hello, everyone. This is Tammy Fisher within the doll world. And I'm here today with my lovely co-host, Miss Georgette Taylor.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Miss Georgette. And today we're welcomed by Dr. Sabrina Thomas. She has a degree in child development. She is a doll collector, an author, an academic. She's a whole package. She's coming here today and giving us some lovely words and teaching us some important things about Black doll history. So Thank you, Dr. Thomas, for coming. And I'm going to refer to you as Sabrina from now on. That's
thank
okay
you.
With you? Okay.
Indeed.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining
us. Yeah, I'm one of your biggest fans.
Yay.
I'm one of your biggest fans.
Yeah, we are excited. It's mm-hmm. always fun to interview people who have seen previous shows. Most people have, but your daughter. So Sabrina came to us because her daughter recommended that we interview her, because Sabrina's daughter said that her mother, you know, is our biggest fan, and she knows all the things about our show. And it's like now we're on the hot spot. It's like, okay, so Sabrina knows about us. So we better be good.
That's funny.
We better be good.
We better be on our best behavior.
Yes. And she comes to the show with so much knowledge about dolls and about the history of dolls. And we really wanted to, you know, be able to showcase that and talk to one of our listeners who really appreciates what we do, but also appreciates the fact that dolls are important. And so we really appreciate you being on the show, Sabrina. Mm-hmm.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for joining us. Okay. So we're going to start with our magic question, as you refer to it.
Yes.
Tell us about your doll journey.
Okay, so when I think about my doll journey, I really think about myself being on like two distinct pathways that sort of weave in and out of each other at various times. So one pathway relates to my identity as a doll collector. And the other relates to my identity as an academic scholar who studies dolls as objects of material culture. And so when I think about my journey as a doll collector, I'm going to tell you about three dolls, and then I'm going to skip and go to the event that occurred that made me sort of embrace my identity as a doll collector. So when I think about collecting, the first doll that entered my collection, I received her as a gift when I was in seventh grade, and my mother gave me the doll. And, you know, it was really interesting to me because in seventh grade, I had stopped playing with dolls. So it was an odd gift to me, but I really appreciated it because it was the first Black doll that I had ever owned.
Wow.
And as an adult, I had asked my mom, I said, well, why did you give me a doll in seventh grade? Right. And she said, it was because when I was younger, I had asked her about a Black doll, and she knew that I had never owned one. And so I guess she wanted to make sure I had one as I was leaving the gate. You know, it was really interesting because in seventh grade, my elementary school went from grade one to grade seven.
Okay.
So being in seventh grade was equivalent to being a mighty senior in high school, right? So, you know, although I really appreciated the doll, I couldn't go back to school after Christmas bragging about, you know, bragging about the doll that my mom gave me, because I was a sensational seventh grader, quite frankly. And I was trying to figure out, oh, I wonder how can I get a second doll, right? Like, how can I get a second doll? Like, can I drop hints? Well, as a sensational seventh grader, that was beneath me. And then I thought, I can save my money and try to buy another doll. But mind you, I didn't have a particular doll in mind. So it was a nameless, faceless doll. And I think that's one reason why I wasn't really motivated to sort of stick with it. Because as a seventh grader, I was also broke, right? So, you know, I had to choose. Do I use my money to save for a doll, or do I live my best life and use my money for candy, cookies, and so on? And I decided my best life. Exactly. So that was a pause, I consider, looking back in my doll collecting journey. But I do want to share with you the doll. This is Molly. This is the doll that my mother gave me when I was in seventh grade. And she's an all cloth doll. You can tell she's beautiful. The color used to dye her fabric had to be this rich chocolate brown, because she's still so beautiful now. She has on a floral dress with little flowers that are orange and pinkish. And then you can clearly see the green leaves. And then she has on a matching undie with it.
Oh, cute.
Yeah.
And I love her little bows, her little
pigtails. Hair is made of black yarn, and it's styled in two pigtails with orange hair bows. And her facial features are all stitched.
Right? Oh, okay.
And so she handmade?
Handmade.
My mom
ordered her from a woman that made dolls at her workplace.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So
right. So she's not mass produced at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? Okay. Very nice. And I
named her Molly because Molly is my family name, and I just wanted her to be Molly. Right.
Nice. So, very cool.
So this is Molly. And then, so between my seventh grade and 12th grade, nothing happened. I didn't acquire any more dolls. I had put a pause to my doll collecting. And summer between my after graduating high school and going to college, I purchased my first doll. And this is a doll I saw in the window as I was going downtown. And it was really odd to me because I saw her in the window of a watch shop. Like, I didn't even know why she would be there. But there were only two of her in the watch shop. And okay. I just had to have her. The reason I was really attracted to her is because she was pink and white, and she matched the bedspreads that I had raised in college. I'm like, oh, she's gonna look lovely with my dorm room. And let me tell you, I'm still broke. Right? So the doll was $19.99. And let me tell you, when I walked into that store to purchase that doll, I felt like I was dropping Benjamins. Because I'm broke, and $20 was a lot of money
to
I want to show you her also. And she is a Bradley collection doll. And I think she's unique because I've studied these dolls just a little bit, and I've never seen a brown version of the Bradley collection.
Yeah, I've never seen one either.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming she's unique in that way. And you can see the beautiful pink and white. She has a big ball gown. Is completely pink, trimmed with rows of white lace. Nice. And she has the matching pink hat that is also trimmed with white lace. And her hair is in a little afro.
It's gorgeous.
Even then, her entire body is foam. It's some kind of hard foam. And and it looks like it's covered with a stocking. Like, if you look under her dress, it covers, I don't know if you can see that, but can you see the stockings?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It covers her complete body. And she has a built-in stand, which was a characteristic of many of the Bradley dolls. And then under the bottom, it has the company's name and all of that. So this is Sarah Elizabeth, but I must admit, I named her Sarah Elizabeth, but Bradley called her Marlene. So she is the Marlene doll from the Bradley collection.
Okay.
So Marlene, aka Sarah Elizabeth, right?
Okay.
So off I go to college, and I have Molly, and I have Sarah Elizabeth. Now, during my sophomore year, one of my classmates saw Sarah Elizabeth in my room, and she said they should have a play date. Now, what's interesting is, even at that time, I had not embraced myself as a doll collector, but what she said made complete sense to me. I said, yeah, they should have a play date. So she brings her doll down to my room, and it was an F&B 1969 doll. And she said her aunt had it and she gave it to her as some going away to college gift, right? So she brings F&B to my room, and then my classmate disappears. I didn't see her for 2 semesters, which meant I had to take F&B home, pack her up over the summer, and bring her back. So I brought her back to college, and then when I eventually saw my classmate again, I said, look, here she is. She missed you. And she said, oh, well, you can keep her and give her back to me after I pledge. And I said, well, why do I have to keep her until you pledge? And she said, because I know that you're going to try to give me a gift after I pledge. And what I want it to be is I want you to buy her a red and white outfit, put it on her, and then give her back to me. Okay. Now, I'm going to be honest. What I was really thinking about when she said that is, look, we're going to have to put that red and white outfit on at the very last minute, because red and white does not go with my room decor. But you know, I kept the doll. Now, you may ask, why do you still have the doll, Sabrina? Well, she left again, and I have not seen her since.
What?
Like, she left, and we had 2 more years in college, and I didn't see her. I graduated, I didn't see her. Now, I did see an ex that she used to date, and I said that might not be a good idea. I just kept the doll. But this is it. It's an F&B 1969. Now, the middle of her body is made of cloth just like Molly's, but her mm-hmm. limbs are vinyl.
Okay.
Okay.
Her limbs are vinyl, and she has on this beautiful white cotton dress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With the matching mm-hmm. undies, and she has these little rose petals like going down the center of the dress cool. for decoration. And then yes. she has bonnet, uh-huh. sweater, and booties. So she's she's a really beautiful doll. And I said, one day my classmate is going to show up and try to claim her. And so I'll just have to think about it. I'm just going to have to do it.
You want to tell us her name in case she's listening? Tell her to come get her baby. No. Come get your baby.
I know. So for that reason, I don't think
get your baby or send child support.
Well, okay, fine. I'll charge her though. I'll maybe charge her over like 2 decades, right?
I know, because you have been taking care of her. You have been
looking good.
Yeah. So now I'm in college and I'm getting ready to leave, and I only have 3 dolls. I have Molly, I have Sarah Elizabeth, and I have the F&B. And I typically don't name my dolls. That's why I'm just referring to her as F&B. But these two, Molly and Sarah Elizabeth, are really the only 2 dolls I've named, with the exception of one I bought last month from Marilyn Bloodworth. She does mm-hmm. peach dolls. Mm-hmm. She's in South Carolina. And so I ordered a doll from her. And you know what? I'm going to be honest. I think the reason I'm going in that direction is because of your show. Because I really began to appreciate what does it mean to bring a doll to market, and what does it mean to support someone's artistic passion for dolls? Mm. Because I have a big collection of mass-produced dolls, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see artists like Marilyn Bloodworth and I see her peach dolls, I'm like, oh, I should support her. And also I want a unique collection, right? Mm-hmm. And so she made a doll. She didn't make me a peach doll, but she made me an Afrocentric doll, one that had mm-hmm. African attire and all. And she texted me and she said, what do you want to name her? And I instantly knew Destiny. Like instantly, I said Destiny.
Oh, nice.
So I only have 3 dolls in my collection that I've actually bothered to name. And that's Molly, Sarah Elizabeth, and Destiny, right? So, okay, back to my journey. I'm graduating from college and I only have those dolls. And so there is this big pause. I'm not receiving any dolls as gifts. I'm not buying any. I did receive one when I was in graduate school, and she was a Madame Alexander. And that was given to me as a gift. This is Madame Alexander, 1965. Mm. This is Leslie,
mm-hmm.
right? And so she has on this like chiffon bouffant pink dress with a nice pink bow on the back. And I just really love her hair, although I haven't combed it necessarily. But, you know, she's one that I acquired many years after graduating college when I was in grad school. But the event that really made me sort of seal my identity as a doll collector, it occurred in 1997, right? So I had graduated. I had my doctorate, just doing my thing. And I walk into Barnes & Noble. And what do I see? I see this. By Myla Perkins, right? Uh-huh. And so I decide I'm just going to, I'm just looking. And I was like, wow, this woman has done so much work in cataloging these dolls. And of course, I was curious whether my little, small collection I had, whether they were in here. And they're all in here. So that validated, right? That validated me. And I decided to purchase the book. And I also, in the end, ended up, of course, buying her second book. So I bought both of them. But then I became very curious about the woman. Like, what does she think? How would she have a conversation with me about dolls? And I eventually contacted her, right? The first time I contacted her, she said, can you call me at this time? Because she owned a daycare and it was just bad timing. And so when we eventually got together, we talked for about 3 hours. Over 3 hours, because it was 3 hours when I start timing it, right? I was a little concerned. I'm like, I'm taking up way too much of her time. But she was the nicest, sweetest woman I've ever spoke to. And she was talking to me just because, right? And she asked, she said, are you a doll collector? And I was hemming and hawing. And I said, my collection is nowhere near as big as yours. And she said, but you have at least three. You have more than one. So you can be a doll collector. And I said, oh, okay. And so, but the point is, we just kept talking about the book. She was telling me about how she wanted to be, she wanted to own every Black doll ever made. And I said, that is ambitious, but you are probably half the way there, right? But she had, if the dolls in the book indicated anything, it was a massive collection. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that sealed the deal for me. I asked for her address to give her a thank you note. She was talking to me for no good reason. I didn't have a research question. I just wanted to talk to the woman behind the book, right? Mm-hmm. Or the books. And so I sent her a thank you card, and she must have just, lifted my return address, and she sent me a doll. It had no note to it. And I'm like, it didn't need one because it was so understood, right? Mm-hmm. She sent me a doll, and the doll she sent me was this Chrissy doll. Chrissy grow hair, and her hair still grows, by the way, but I don't like playing with it, so I have to. And this particular pink and white kind of, calico looking print of her dress, it seemed to be very popular for dolls in the late 70s. Like I see this dress, this pattern on a lot of dolls. Mm-hmm. Even Barbie had this particular one, and she's a vinyl doll, and she's just beautiful. Her dress has, the cotton lace trim, as opposed to the other ones had more of that sort of real fancy lace work. This is more cotton, something. And then she has the little bow here. So
I think I think that's gingham. I'm not positive, that's that pattern. Yes.
Okay. This was very popular among dolls. And because of Myla Perkins, I decided to embrace my identity as a doll collector. And I guess in her own subtle way, she added one more doll to my collection to give me encouragement. So that is essentially my sort of journey as it relates to my identity as a doll collector. Now, since then, I've collected way too many dolls, but that's my sort of doll collector's journey. When I think about my academic journey, I would go back to graduate school. And remember, I said they sort of weave in and out of each other. So what happens now is anytime I'm researching a doll, I really feel that I should own that doll. So I go, I look for, and I purchase her if I can afford her. I purchase her. And then by definition, that's expanding my collection. So my research informs my collection as well, right? But when I think about how I got on this sort of academic path, I was in graduate school and not for my PhD. My PhD has nothing to do with dolls at all. But my master thesis was all about dolls. And so I think that was the sort of where it started emerging, and I just didn't recognize it at the time. So my area was early childhood psychological development. And of course, when you're taking classes like that in grad school, the Clark and Clark doll choice study is going to come up as a basis for saying that, you know, Black children have low self-esteem. And this is one of the tests we give them, and we can determine that. So, you know, we have a class, we're talking about it, and I eventually tell my advisor that I want to do my thesis on an examination of the validity of the Dahl Choice study.
For those people who don't know, can you briefly, you know, just sum up the Clark study?
The Clark,
because it's significant.
Sure. Okay, great. Yeah, that's right. Sure. So Mamie and Kenneth Clark, essentially, now they ask white kids this too, but the focus has always, historical focus has always been on Black kids. So I'm just going to focus on the Black kids. So essentially what they did, if you were to Google the Clark and Clark doll study, this is a very common image you're going to see. These particular two dolls, and these are F&B dolls as well. And these are also the same F&B dolls that you will find in the African American Museum in Washington, D.C. This is how they represent the Clark and Clark doll study as well. So essentially in the study, Kenneth and Mamie Clark held up two dolls, one white, the other Black, and they asked the children, they were preschoolers, ages 4 to 7. And they said, can you show me the doll that is the nice doll? Can you show me the doll that is the pretty doll? Can you show me the doll that you'd like to play with? And the Black children disproportionately preferred the white doll in terms of responding to questions that had positive attributes, right? But when they asked questions like, show me which doll is the ugly doll, they would disproportionately pick the Black doll. Now, that was significant because not only did the children show a preference for the white doll when it came to positive attributes, they also understood that the Black doll was a representation of themselves. Mm-hmm. They had a clear understanding of that. And they understood that when they were rejecting the Black doll, in a sense, perhaps they were rejecting themselves, because when you look at some of the qualitative notes related to that study, they would talk about how the children would pause.
The question that they were asked specifically was, which doll looks most like you?
Exactly. Which doll looks like you? But this is usually after they've made all their other attributions with the positive ones going towards the white doll. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what Clark and Clark determined was that when they concluded their study, what they said was what their study indicated was that children as young as 3 years old have an awareness of the racial hierarchy that we have in our society. Not only do they have an understanding of that racial hierarchy, mm-hmm. they also have a sense of themselves in that hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. And they can also identify things that are said to represent them, as in being a person of color, however that color is defined. Now, that is what the Clark and Clark study said. Now, my research, however, simply concluded that although this is the Clark's findings, it does not say that Black children have low self-esteem. Empirically, it's just not supported, right? Mm-hmm. But that's okay, because I understand the iconic nature of the Clark and Clark study is not so much that it's such solid research, it's because it pulls at the emotional strings of care about the development of children, generally speaking, and with a special focus on Black children. So I get why it's so iconic and so significant when you're talking about doll studies. The other question that it posed for me, however, and this is what sort of took me on my academic journey, was how can we observe how children act on their dolls in more natural settings? And then what does it suggest to us about their racial understanding, right? Mm-hmm. So with the Clark and Clark study, we witnessed how they acted on dolls, but more so in response to predetermined questions. And so my question was, can we get more just by observing them in their natural habitats? Now, I'll tell you, after my thesis, I had that question in my mind, but I moved on and I paused even my academic journey, right? And I went on and finished my doctorate in human development and family studies. had nothing to do with dolls at all. And then I later came back. I just revisited the question. I received a grant to do it from the American Association of University Women, and they funded me going into the archives to sort of, and I do a lot of work in archives, right? That's why I'm particularly excited when I see people build archives. And let me interrupt myself for a minute. I know the interview is supposed to be about me, right? I get that. But give me a second. Because what I really want to say or point out is shows like yours, like In the Doll World, you are creating this archaeological site for doll study. And I don't know, and I don't think you're doing it intentionally, but that's a great contribution you're making to the discipline of child development, generally speaking, right? And then just imagine if you pair the work that the two of you are doing, Tammy and Georgette, I mean, it's awesome, right? Pair it with someone like Debbie Garrett. Put the work that you all are doing together, and it's like a gold mine for academics who don't know you, but they will know you in a few minutes. You understand what I'm saying? They will know you in a few minutes. And so I just wanted to say that because this is larger than even the present moment. And I've heard you all talk about some of the things you want to do with your podcast, and you understand that you're reaching people that you didn't even expect, and that, you know, the doll world is complicated and layered, right?
Yes.
But I don't think you've seen your moment yet. And I'm just going to sit that there. I'm just going to sit that there, and then I'm going to return to the program as scheduled. Okay.
Thank you for what you said.
Yes, thank you.
It's true. And so where was I? Oh, the Clark study. So back to my journey, my academic journey. And so I wanted to ask the question about how do children act upon their dolls, and what can we understand about the racial, their racial understanding.
So Hold on, I'm sorry to interrupt you right here, because there's something that we didn't talk about with the Clark study. I understand what you're saying about, from the scientific standpoint, the rigor, you know, wasn't there.
Yeah.
But that study is very significant, not only from the standpoint of what they came up with, but that study led to integration.
Right.
The schools became integrated, exactly. And the country became, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
And I think that's what makes it so iconic. So when the Clark doll study was tethered to the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education,
right.
Mm-hmm. It seared itself into the American consciousness, mm-hmm. as a baseline for understanding children's notion of self, right? And I say, mm-hmm. that very, very loosely, but I do believe that people, one reason it is so appealing, and one reason we continue to talk about it today, because you'll notice that when new Black dolls come to market, mm-hmm. and the journalists are talking about the great release, they glance back to the Clark and Clark study.
Yes, they do.
Almost 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So it is truly iconic, and I admire the work of Mamie and Kenneth Clark, because their research does what every researcher wants their work to do. It changes things, it influences conversations, and it makes a difference, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we do what we do, right? So I certainly don't mean to take anything from Clark and Clark. As a matter of fact, they're the ones that put me on my academic journey, right? Exactly. So what I did after receiving the American Association of University Women's grant to go into the archives, I looked at the 1897 Stanley Hall, A Study of Dolls. And that's a study that people don't talk about a lot. But what G. Stanley Hall and Caswell did is they sent out all these questionnaires to teachers in the New England states. And this is 1897. So we're talking about kids who were children in 1897. And they were all white children, you know, of course, because that's where they sent things. And then I looked at the 1987 Oral Doll History Project that was sponsored by the Strong Museum, also in Rochester, because I attended the University of Rochester. And that's why I had a sort of intimate knowledge of the Strong Museum. And I later found out that they had this 1984 Oral Doll History Project. I simply combined the two of those studies in terms of raw data, and neither of them intended to talk about race, right? That's not what they were formed. But because I could go in and look at the raw interviews, the raw transcripts, I could take from them what I needed to answer the question, how do children act upon their dolls in a racialized manner? And what does it tell us about their understanding of race and race relations? So it was interesting to me, and I'm going to shoot through this quickly because I don't want to, you know, drag it on. But the point is this, the women were born between 18, they experienced childhood between 1897 and 1928, essentially. And what I determined in that particular research project is that many of the little white girls, and I know I was looking at adult women, but many of them saw their childhood as a Black doll was present as a representation of their real lives. So for those who did not own a doll outside of financial restrictions, some of them, you know, dolls were luxuries, right? They were luxury items. Everyone couldn't afford a doll. But for those who could, one mentioned that she really did love her Black doll because it reminded her of the woman who cared for her family. And that would have been the maid, the mammy, or, you know, however she was construing it. One little girl also said that she was the only one in her peer group that had a Black doll, and it was a servant doll. And, you know, tea parties were huge back then. And so every Sunday they would have a tea party, and her friends would remind her to bring Essie because they needed someone to serve the tea to the other dolls that would be at the tea party. But what was interesting to me are those women who said the reason they did not have a doll is because, or at least their understanding of it, is because they didn't see Black people. And it made sense to them that a Black doll would not be in their doll space because there were no Black people in their real life. And so what it says is that when we look at how we curate the social environment of children, whether we're talking about neighborhoods, schools, or their play spaces, what is real to them is what they see, right? Mm-hmm. And if it's not in their particular play space, then you have to wonder, how do they come up with ideas about what does it mean to be a Black person? And where do they look for that information? So that's in a nutshell what I did there. But what I'm doing now is I was so curious about how Black women would respond to my same questions, right? So I recruited 100 Black women born between 1900 and 1940. Of course, I allowed some others in the 50s and 60s to join because many of them came, you know, as friends, and I wanted to include everybody, and they gave some really great information. So, and I asked them, what is the significance of a Black doll for you? And we're talking about Jim Crow, right? And all of these women were born in the South. I did that intentionally because I wanted them to at least theoretically have a shared experience of Jim Crow as opposed to some women who may have been born in the North. But interestingly enough, they almost split down the middle, with some women thinking that, well, yeah, the Black doll was very significant because we needed positive representation in the Black community. There were others who said for them, within the context of Jim Crow segregation, the Black doll was insignificant. Because what they needed from the Black doll, they got from their school teachers. And it was not until after the schools were desegregated that they assumed that Black doll acquired more significance, particularly for their children and their grandchildren. Because they were saying that one thing we lost during desegregation was the daily validation of brown kids. Because you just don't get that with teachers now. Well, it's believed you don't get that with the teachers now. And so they believe that curating this material culture around their children and their grandchildren would essentially help with their self-esteem. And that particular chapter is one that serves as an anchor in my book that I'm working on. And I do think it is very close to being finished. It's going to be out of my hands by the end of the summer. And then, you know, I tell you, Tammy and Georgette, getting a book to market is about as complicated as bringing a doll to market sometimes, right? So, you know, I'm just doing my thing, but I'm going to complete this book. It's going to be a great book. And so that's what that sort of speaks to my academic journey.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
You mentioned my daughter sending you you this Sarah Lee article that I wrote.
Yes.
And Sarah Lee is interesting because that's where my academic scholarship began to go in writing biographies of Black dolls. But my focus was more so on the production process. Like, how did Sarah Lee come to market? Not so much that she was just a significant Black doll in the early 1950s. She was really like 1951 to 1953. But why would someone like Zora Neale Hurston be interested in a doll? You know, mm-hmm. a Black doll. Usually when we think about Zora Neale Hurston, we're not thinking about dolls. We're thinking about her great literary talents, right? But Zora Neale Hurston was so committed to this notion of proper Black representation that she signed on to a project with a friend of hers, Sarah Lee Creech, who's really the lead person and the doll's namesake, to establish this pathway of building or manufacturing Black dolls for Black children. And I thought that was fascinating that someone, that a race leader, right, as iconic mm-hmm. as Zora Neale Hurston would be interested in manufacturing a Black doll. And so I wrote about Sarah Lee sort of from that vantage point. So the way I wrote about her then is not as a collector, but as more as a scholar.
Can you tell us the significance of the Sarah Lee doll?
Right. So the Sarah Lee doll was significant because she was considered to be the first anthropologically correct doll. Right. So mm-hmm. she's not the first Black doll that came to market. And she certainly wasn't the first Black doll that the Ideal Toy Company brought to market. They had at least two before her. One was called Black Flexi. And this was supposed to be the Black version of a white soldier doll that they had. But it was interesting when they produced Black Flexi, they did not put him in military uniform. They put him in suspenders, things that looked like he was a jig, an entertainer, right? So it was in a sense degrading attire, but mm-hmm. that's what they chose to dress him in. But he was supposed to be the counterpart to a white military doll they had. They also had another doll, and I'm blocking. I want to say, no, it wasn't Daisy. Oh, it was Black Snow White. They did a Black Snow White doll, and those were the two they had prior to Sarah Lee. What made Sarah Lee significant is, one, she had sort of the blessing of an anthropologist who said she was an anthropologically correct doll. She wasn't just a Black doll. She captured the essence of being Black with the head measurements. And this is Sarah Lee. Now, in that process, what Zora Neale Hurston did was she took pictures of several Black children and she sent those pictures to the designer of the doll. Now, theoretically, it's supposed to mean that the measurement of the doll is according to what, you know, the size of Negro brains and heads. And, you know, that's really not surprising when you think about the fact that it's Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, she's an anthropologist. And at that time, they were still into people of different races having different head sizes and brain sizes. And so, but Sarah Lee is also significant then because her development, as in the process itself, the development showed the ideology of makers, right? Because no one else but Zora Neale Hurston is going to decide that, oh, let me give you some measurements of Black children so you can make the proper Black doll for Negro people, right? You know what? Let me tell you a story I just thought about. I can't believe I didn't think of this. I spoke, I had an interview with John Hope Franklin, and he is an amazing Black historian, right? And I was talking to him because I just wanted to get his take on dolls. Now, he wasn't particularly interested in dolls, but when I told him what Zora Neale Hurston had done in terms of marking this as an anthropologically correct doll, he sort of grinned and said, you know, that sounds like something she would do, right? And I just thought it was a simple response, but he really did capture the essence of it is important who makes these dolls because they bring a particular discourse to the table about these dolls. This doll is also significant because former lady Eleanor Roosevelt signed on. And what Zora Neale Hurston also did was she pulled together all of the presidents of HBCUs at the time and got them to sign on to this doll. That had never in the history of Black doll production been done before, right? So she was significant, but she didn't last long. She was, like I said, 1951 to 1953. They had other dolls competing. We had, you know, she had some contemporary dolls that were, you know, probably less expensive, but also more interesting. The Amos and Andy Amasandra doll, more a little stereotypical, but, you know, she just had, she had competitors. And the ideal toy company was never really committed to her. They end up signing on saying, okay, we'll make her if you want to, only because Eleanor Roosevelt signed on. And they decided it would make good publicity for the company, but they were never really backing her as a doll. So she didn't last very long, but she's significant to me because she is the first doll that I decided to write from a biographical and doll production perspective about.
I don't remember hearing you speak about why Sara Lee Creech made her.
So Sara Lee Creech decided. So Sara Lee Creech was a white woman who lived in Belle, Florida, some part of Florida, right? And she was a part of the Interracial Council. Mm-hmm. So Sara Lee tells the story. Sara Lee Creech tells the story that she's walking out of the post office one day, right? And she looks and she sees these two young Black girls sitting in the back of a car playing with a white doll. And she found that was disturbing. She's like, they should have their own Black doll. And then she talks about how she goes and she researches the history of Black dolls. She bumps into the Clark and Clark dolls, of course, right? And she decides that based on their research findings that children believe that they are less than, that she should try to develop a doll. And then she goes down the path of doing it.
The significance with Zora Neale Hurston is that they were friends.
They were friends. That's how they connected.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And Zora Neale spent a lot of time in Florida and she was on that council as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's Sara Lee. And that is my doll journey and my academic journey with dolls. And all of this will culminate, of course, in the book.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's empowering.
So what did you find that was surprising when you were doing your book? Like what came out of the book that you did not either know or that you were really surprised about when you started compiling that information?
When I'm talking about the women that I interview, it's just the ideologies of Blackness are so different and so complex and so layered. Mm-hmm. It wasn't surprising in the sense that we know the Black race is just, I mean, we're colorful. We're a colorful group of people, right? And if you don't even buy the Black right binary, then the human race is so broad in terms of its colors. And there were some women who felt the mulatto doll was just as good as a deep chocolate doll. Some thought the medium brown doll was more important. So I think what was not so much surprising, but very intriguing was the fact that there were so many different opinions about whether or not the Black doll was significant as an object of racial uplift.
Mm-hmm. Mm, wow.
And one of the things about Sara Lee was they had a committee of people decide upon her color.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're talking about color and the significance. A group of people had to make that decision.
Yeah. And so that's that's another thing that Zora Neale Hurston brought to the table. She helped to create this color, they called it the color jury, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it had Ralph Bunche on it, who, you know, was the first Black Nobel Prize winner. It had Mary McLeod Bethune, Mordecai. They had some presidents of HBCUs. And the sole purpose of their meeting was to get together and determine how dark or how light this doll should be. And that what that spoke to is the significance of the color complex in the Black community. It matters to people. Yeah, it matters to people. And I also think that's why when we see, you know, I remember when I think it was in like 2009 when the So and Style dolls came out and people were saying, oh, well, they're beautiful, but we need, you know, what about the color? Every time a new doll comes to market, there is some complaint about the color.
The color.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's something about the color.
The color, the hair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The hair is too long. It's too silky.
Yes.
The market is getting a lot better in terms of the diversity of representation, even within the Black community. But I think that's why sometimes, or not sometimes, maybe in the future, we're going to see, or we do see, multiple dolls being released in multiple shades now. Mm-hmm. Just to avoid the talk about, well, how can one color represent the entire race of Black people?
Right.
Because that's always a debate, always a debate. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's interesting, this thing about the hair, you know, as early as like 1910, we had club women who, even though they were very much against the mammy doll and they were thinking about the construction of a new doll, they clearly said we must keep the hair because hair is one of the major pastimes of doll play. And everyone wants a doll that you can comb their hair. No one wants the molded hair doll. Little girls want to comb hair. They want to wash hair. The more, the better. The longer, the better.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting now to see this with some of these newer doll makers and the human hair. You know, so we've got some of these new play lines, and I haven't seen them on anything other than the play lines, human hair dolls. I mean, there may be some other ones. I just don't.
You know, I don't think Linda B, she's someone you interview. I don't think her dolls have natural hair, but they are amazing. And Linda B is one doll that I did decide that I wanted. Did I tell you guys that I shop from your show now?
You told us earlier that you shop.
Yeah, I do. I shop. You're like my little QVC.
we need to go back and get our percentage.
I listen to the podcast, and then after you interview various artists, I go and I go to the website and I decide what I want to get. And
but those are fresh dolls. That's Dr. Lisa.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
We haven't interviewed her yet. She sent us something in for the Black Doll Celebration.
The celebration.
But we have her scheduled for next month.
Yeah.
We're excited about that interview. Yeah. And they sent us a doll to give away, their Marisol.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. We're excited about Dr. Lisa.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she's going to be a great interview. I'm looking forward. Don't tell me anything more. Don't tell me.
Well, I can't tell you anymore. We haven't interviewed her.
Okay, because I'm a listener and I have to, you know, I have to bring you in the way I bring you in.
You have to, right. Okay. We get it. We understand that.
So how do you set things up to bring us in? You have like get your tea and your cookies and how do you do us?
You know what?
How do you do us? That's awesome.
This is how I do you all off different ways, but this is one of the major ways. If I'm going to go and do something in my doll room, then I'm listening to you because it's like, now the other way I do you all is when I really don't feel like sweeping and stuff, I just put you on and then I get the food.
Right?
So it has to be motivation, but it's just something I look forward to on Saturdays. I really look forward to it because you're talking about something that I'm passionate about and I want to hear all the different angles of in the doll world, right? And it's a perfect title because it's wide open. Like, what really is going on in the doll world, right? Tell me,
Georgia's right? Wonderful title.
Right. So, you know, like I said, I just really think you all have, I think you all really have something there.
Very cool. So let me ask you this question. We definitely appreciate that. Do you listen to the podcast more than you watch the videos, or do you do both, or do you have a preference?
So here's the thing. I think I listen more so to the podcast because that's how I started. That's the journey I started with you. So I know it by podcast. And I'm also with the podcast, I'm not restricted in terms of where I can be. So I enjoy being able, like I've taken you all on a walk with me before. and at the end, we were both tired, like all three of us. Right? But the point is—
Well, thank you, because I need to be getting my exercise.
I was going to say, we did
appreciate that. We appreciate that.
Yeah, but because it's a podcast, I hit it, put it in, and I go walking. So I get things done. at the same time. And it just gives me, again, the freedom of movement.
Very cool.
Now, I'll tell you, I've gone to the YouTube channel more when I'm shopping, because I'm trying to actually see sort of the visual, if there is a visual there. And also from the YouTube, I can easily click any link that is provided, you know, to me. And I can shop right there on YouTube.
That's so very good.
It works. You all give me a lot of flexibility, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you. We're happy about that.
Yep.
Wow. All I can say, Sabrina, is you have a world of knowledge and information. I was so enthralled, like, listening to you talk
really?
About this.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
No, really. I really was. Because I think it's so important that people understand that, right? People understand the history of all of those things, whether it be, you know, Sara Lee, whether it be the doll test or anything like that. Yeah. I just think that is always so important. Like you said, when you're looking up dolls, when you're thinking about dolls, those things show up and people don't really understand the breakdown of it or how they actually do connect to each other. So I really appreciate you bringing that knowledge and the history to the show. I really do.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
And you all keep doing what you're doing, because I tell you, I think this is amazing work. And I mean, and maybe this is just my academic eye, but I just see it as it is an archaeological site for doll studies. And you all are really pushing the doll field forward. And I've never seen anything like it, quite frankly. I just really appreciate. You know what? It's really also important during COVID.
That's
a way. It was just a way of connecting with like-minded folks.
Yeah.
Right. And hearing people talk about what you're passionate about, and that itself, particularly during COVID, was therapy for me.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate your work.
Yeah, COVID kicked it off for us, because Georgette and I think we did our first interview with Debbie like maybe in October.
November.
Yeah, we were just kind of kicking it around, trying to figure out what we wanted to do. And I think we were just kind of shy about, you know, how do we do this and whatever. And then COVID hit. And I said, Georgette, we got to get these shows out, because people are at home. It's depressing. We got to get the shows out. And so, this is about COVID, and you've been following us long enough to know, especially those early shows, it was about what's going on. And so when we started out, we were saying we were trying to connect people, you know, doll lovers and doll makers.
Right.
And then after the first few interviews, it's like, these people are not just doll makers. You know, business owners and entrepreneurs. So then we changed our mission to include that.
Yeah, I heard you. I heard that podcast where you made that switch.
Okay.
In terms of broadening your, you know, understanding that you were a lot bigger than you had imagined.
Yeah, totally.
I remember that podcast.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And so it just keeps getting bigger. And for me, the thing is, I'm in love with what we're doing. I enjoy what we're doing.
I'm in love with what you're doing too.
And it's growing so quickly.
Yes.
And that, for better or for worse, you know, it's growing so quickly. Yeah. Because it's like, how greatness do we rein it in?
Yeah.
You know, how
greatness has a way of sneaking up on you.
What does?
Greatness.
Oh.
Thank you.
Yeah, because it's like, it just feels... It feels unreal. We will be celebrating our first anniversary next week. We've already interviewed Mel Odom, Robert Tonner, Stacey McBride, Irby. I mean, just Doug James is one of the founding fathers. Paulette Goudreau, one of the, you know, founding people.
Yeah.
You know, and
some of them I didn't know. I was like, okay, I'm learning too.
Yeah, so like with Doug James, I knew Doug James, but I didn't know Doug James was who he. Like, if I met Georgette at the grocery store and we become friends and we start talking, and I don't know that Georgette connected to Deja,
right?
And so then it's like, or even when I met Georgette, I knew she created Deja. I don't think I knew that Deja was the first full size
doll.
A fashion doll. I don't think I knew that when I.
So Georgette is pushing the envelope before Mattel catches up.
Yeah, before
way before. Right.
Exactly. And that's why you have to highlight these independent entrepreneurs the way that you do.
I think for me, when I thought about the show, it was to do just that. It was really just to highlight the people that did the work, right? Did, you know, so like a peek behind, you know, the doll on the shelf kind of thing, you know, like who makes these dolls? What are they about? And the fact that I did know that they were entrepreneurs, but my, you know, like I said, my goal was just to really showcase them, but also be able to showcase them to people who were not in the community. Because, you know, I thought the people in the community knew everybody in the community, right? So, but I know that's not totally true anymore.
And you're interviewing people. I can't remember her name, but the one who does the articulated dolls, I think she's in China or
Japan. That's
Japan.
Emilia.
Okay. I wouldn't have known about her.
Okay.
I just wouldn't have known.
Yes. This has been such a wonderful interview. It's been so enlightening and inspiring. And we are just excited to have had you come and join us. Yeah. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me. I just think the world of the two of you the work that you're doing in the doll world.
Thank you so much. So, let our listeners find out where they can find you at, or maybe your upcoming book or things that you're writing about, and share that with us. That'd be great.
Well, you know, for now, I would like to invite all of your listeners to simply join a Facebook page. It's called The Doll Chat Club. And it really is just a group of folks who love talking about dolls, and they meet in the same way a book club would. So just think of it as a book club that meets once a month, but it's about dolls, right? So I invite you to come and visit the Doll Chat Club, and it's on Facebook, and feel free to join. We'd be happy to have you.
Great. Well, thank you so much again, Sabrina, for being on In the Doll World with us. We really appreciate it. And we're excited that you are an avid listener. And we just really appreciate the time that you take to listen to our show and share it with everybody. So thank you so much again for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to In the Doll World. Me and Tammy really hope that you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to share our podcast with other doll enthusiasts such as yourself. And if you would like to leave a message on how you enjoyed the show, or you want to suggest any guests that we should interview, as well as share information about what's happening in the doll community in your area, please know that you can reach out to us at georgette.inthedollworld@gmail.com and or tammy.inthedollworld@gmail.com. Also, if you want to see some of the photos we will be posting of our guests, as well as the dolls that they talk about on the show, please visit www.inthedollworld.com. And until next week, add a little play into your life by collecting a doll, sharing a doll, or giving a doll a home. Until next week, thank you again for listening to In the Doll World.